It's time now for Bucks Blue with host Joe LeComp and Yardley Borough Police Chief Joseph Kelly. Bucks Blue is a monthly spotlight show that focuses on highlighting community policing in your neighborhood. Here now is your host, Yardley Borough Police Chief Kelly.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the February edition of Bucks Blue here on WBCB 1490 AM and 107.3 FM. Eric, today we're going to have a pretty exciting show. We have our biggest guest so far of our very, very short history here on Bucks Blue on WBCB. We're hosting Jim Fitzgerald. Jim's a former Ben Salem police officer and also a retired U.S. FBI agent, where he served as a supervisory special agent in their elite behavioral analysis unit. Jim, are you on with us?
Good to be on.
Great to have you, Jim. And welcome to Bucks Blue. We know that you have a robust history here in Bucks County, growing up in Philadelphia and then serving the good people of Bucks. Can you walk us through a little bit of the early years of Jim Fitzgerald and what drove you to police work?
Well, I know you know, I've written three books about my journey. That's why I called it A Journey to the Center of the Mind, all three books in my memoir series. And a lot of people over the years have asked me that question, and including my kids, wanted to know more information. Why don't you put it down in writing someday? So I did, and those books were published over the last 6 or 7 years. But basically, yeah, I grew up in a row home in the Olney neighborhood of Philadelphia, and, you know, in my book sometimes, you know, we ran from the cops when we were hanging out at Lowell Schoolyard or something like that, and they wanted us out of there. You know, I was not exactly an angel growing up, but I always had a respect for police officers. And when I got into college, a few of my friends, older friends, or at least their older brothers, joined the Philly police force. And they'd sometimes work 3 to 11 shifts, and we'd meet up with them afterwards. And I would just sit in awe and listen to some of their stories from just that night shift, and not to mention the week before or the month before. And I said, man, what an interesting job that must be. And so I was at Penn State, and I think my first major was English. Then I switched over to psychology. Then I learned they had this new program called Law Enforcement and Corrections. Now it's criminal justice. But I said, you know, it's kind of psychology and police work and doing something besides an office-type job. But I didn't want to be a police officer. In fact, I did an internship with the Pennsylvania Board of Probation and Parole. I was down at their K&A office.
Okay.
I'm not even sure what that neighborhood is like now, if they still have an office there. I know it's not a very desirable neighborhood. I've seen some videos. Anyway, and that summer I was actually handling a small caseload and talking to some clients, all nonviolent, you know, folks and all. So, oh, probation and parole, that's what I want to be. Anyway, that didn't work out, and jobs were tight in the mid-70s. Took a bunch of police tests. I basically said, whoever hires me first, I'll go with. And Ben Salem was the one, and started there in 76, went to the PA State Police Academy for 12 weeks, even though I was back when police departments still, you know, would sponsor and put their cadets, their new hirees through the academy. I know it's all different now with, is it Act 480 or?
Act 120.
Act 120, okay. And anyway, that's all different in PA now, but I was glad to go through and be trained by the state troopers, and started in November of 76 on my first shift at Ben Salem PD, and made headlines in the Bucks County Courier Times next day, Joe, and for a good thing, not a bad thing.
And what happened that first night? I mean, everybody remembers their first night. I worked part-time for a police department while in college, and my first night full-time was actually in the Belmar riots in 1992. So I had a pretty exciting first night, too. But from what I remember in the book, you had even a more exciting first night. So why don't you walk us through a little bit about what happened that night?
Well, yeah, and just a little bit of background. When I first graduated college, no job was falling in place, and I took a position as a store detective at the old Strawbridge and Clothier department store in Center City, Philly, at 8th and Market. It's no longer there. The whole company shut down. But I was a store detective there, and you know, chasing a bunch of shoplifters up and down Market Street and 8th Street, and it was, you know, quite an adventure for about 14 months. But here, ironically, my first night on the job as a Ben Salem police officer, I'm with my training officer, and we get a call to, let me see, it was the old Two Guys department store, I believe.
I remember Two Guys.
Yeah, and an alarm went off, and we went there and kind of went back and forth and did our best to circle the place, and, you know, and other backups came. And we finally went in, and they put the canine dog in, and I'm just kind of the rookie officer, you know, coming along here. And I'm thinking, oh, here I'm back in the department store. I can't get away from this this environment. And lo and behold, the dogs found three different guys hiding in there. I mean, they were together, of course. But they broke in. I think one was a juvenile, two adults, or something like that. And we arrested them. And to me, it was a routine. You know, we put cuffs on them, walk them out, no fights. They did have tools. They were there to steal stuff. They had a car in the back. I'm not even sure what they're going to get out of Two Guys of all that much value. So I routinely, you know, process them. I'm learning all the paperwork as we go along, and all my academy training, how to handcuff and handle people and search them adequately and all this stuff. And, you know, really no story after that. Just go home, 7 o'clock in the morning. It was 11 to 7 shift overnight. And I come in the next day, next evening, to an 11 o'clock shift. And these guys from the other shift, including some of my own, oh, are you the Fitzgerald guy? I kind of look at my badge, kind of being sardonic. Yeah, it says Fitzgerald, you know, the nameplate. And, yeah, made headlines already. So what are you talking about? Said, you know, I've been here 5 years. I've never had my name in the paper yet. Who do you know, Fitzgerald? Who do I know? No, I don't know anyone. I'm living in Philly. I have no connections to Ben Salem. Don't know any politicians. What are you talking about? And someone walks in with the then afternoon version of the Bucks County Courier Times. And this is an antiquated term, but I'll say it anyway. Above the fold, which means it was a top story, so it's above where the paper would sort of be folded in half, there it says, rookie has busy first night. And it's a little block article, and it's in my book. I made a copy of it. And sure enough, just recounts my arrest from the night before of these three guys at Two Guys department store. And I actually think some officers resented me for that for a number of years to come, because they literally thought I had some political connection or a newspaper connection. I said, I didn't call this in, I assure you. It was my first night. And but anyway, I did, it was cut out, and you know, I did save it for my scrapbook. But yeah, I've, unfortunately, over the years, there's been sad stories of officers on their first night who have been injured or worse. But this one was sort of a happy story. Well, I guess except for the guys who were arrested, but other than that.
And I can imagine that paper didn't do you any favors. You know, going into a bigger PD and being the new guy, as you indicated, it's you don't even want to be seen for those first couple of months. You just want to get in and get out to your car and really not be seen or make any wake. So I understand exactly what you went through. But at Ben Salem, you also served in a number of capacities. I know you only did 11 years. I shouldn't say only. Only 11 years is an eternity to some people. But you served as a patrol officer, detective, a sergeant in both patrol and in investigations. Could you walk us through a little bit about your time there at Ben Salem?
Yeah, and I when I wrote my second book, which is all about my Ben Salem police years, those 11 years, as you stated, Joe, I did want to create kind of the human side of things. A lot of police issues were going on, you know, cities burning and cops, you know, being suspected of, you know, hands up, don't shoot, which all that was, you know, thrown out the window after a while. So I really tried to humanize it. I the first couple chapters is strictly about the first 20 pages, what's the very first night like to be a police officer? And I walk the reader through that, and of course the arrest down the line and all that stuff. But that same evening. But yeah, so let me see. I did about I did a little over a year in uniform patrol, and a position opened up for what was then called the tactical squad, and it was a 6-person unit of plainclothes officers with a sergeant. And I didn't even think of putting in, but other people were putting, I'm going to put it anyway. What you learn around here, you put in for like 5 things, you get turned down the 6th time, you know, they kind of have no choice. I said, yeah, I'm still too young. I'm not going to. So my sergeant pulled me aside, an old guy named Gene Ashton, who's actually a World War II vet. He was a Marine. And, I say this lovingly, he wore a toupee. It was kind of obvious that he did. But, and, you know, we're back in the mid-70s for a police officer. That was kind of unusual, but a great guy. So, Fitzgerald, you're one of the best rookies I've seen. Put in for that position. You may be surprised. Well, Sarge, if you're kind of ordering me. So I did put in for it, and lo and behold, I got it. And I didn't know how I got it. And once again, I didn't know anybody in the newspaper. I didn't know anybody in politics. I wasn't best friends with any chiefs or lieutenants or anything like that. But they seemingly liked my track record and my arrest record and, you know, this, that, and the other. So then I get back there. The first day as a plainclothes police officer, sergeant pulls me in. Just want you to know, Fitzgerald, I don't want you here. You don't belong here. There are veteran cops out there that have been around 5-8 years. They should be here, not you. I said, well, nice to meet you too, Sarge. I called him Sergeant Wacky in my second book. I give a few pseudonyms to people in the book. In my book, it's if you're a sergeant on down, I give you a pseudonym. If you're a lieutenant or above, I use your real name, unless it's something that went public. So anyway, I said, thanks a lot. But anyway, within weeks, it's an adaption going from uniform patrol to plainclothes. And quite frankly, back then, most of our job consisted of sitting at Neshaminy Mall and trying to catch car thieves.
Okay.
Also, there's a few train stations in Bensalem, Cornwell's, Trevo's. What was it? One other one, I think. But you know, we would sit there someday. They were very boring. Really nothing else was happening. Sometimes you see a drug deal go down. I did do one undercover drug deal. We had an informant. He, you know, met with me. This is now a year in. I have a, you know, I wouldn't shave for a few days in a row. My hair is pretty much, you know, back to touching my shoulders again, denim jackets. So I did do one undercover drug buy, but I never went undercover per se. And I have friends in the FBI who did, and that's a whole different ball game. And, you know, some police officers have done that too. So that was like the first big step. It was really a lateral transfer, no more money. Frankly, kind of lost overtime. You didn't get as much overtime in this plainclothes unit. But it was really fun. I learned a lot. There's a few chapters in my book I devote to that, including following these perverts around. We used to call them perverts around the Chamonix Mall, guys that would follow attractive women, and they would sort of take care of business in the car, and we would catch them. And looking back, when I became a profiler, well, these guys, you know, it was just like an early predisposition to some sort of sexual assault or whatever, but never really been even searched on this particular topic alone. And again, that's in my book. So I got kind of fed up with Sergeant Wacky after 2 years, and I just said, you know what, put me back in patrol. So for the next couple of years in patrol, politics changed. A new chief came in named Rich Viola. He was out of Philly. He was a sergeant out of Philly, former Marine, a good leader, a good, you know, by the book kind of guy. And he wanted to expand the CID, Criminal Investigative Division. And he brought in some acting detectives. I came in, worked for Jack Robinson, who was the detective lieutenant. And then they gave a test. And for sergeant and detective, I took both. And ultimately, I came out number one in both tests. This is like, I think, the spring of 83. And they said, well, which one do you want? I said, well, the 10% raise as a sergeant, 5% as a detective. Detective's kind of more interesting, but I'll take sergeant. So I did take sergeant. And then they called me and said, would you be detective sergeant? And I'd only been an acting detective for a few months then, but I said, sure, okay. So, Joe, here I am, 27 years old. I did an informal survey. I'm the youngest detective sergeant anywhere in the region, and I'm now supervising these guys, you know, with 5, 10, some of them 15 years on as detectives alone. And it's an interesting scenario at that point. But did the best I could, and I was still learning how to work cases as a detective. But I was applying my management skills. And also at this time, I had gone back to school to get a master's degree at Villanova. And this is before online or distance. So the PD wouldn't give us off for this. So I had to take vacation time or switch shifts with people, whatever. So at least one night a week, I was driving from Bensalem over to Villanova, about an hour, and taking a graduate class. And Took about 5 years, but eventually got that degree. So, detective sergeant, politics change. That's a whole other side story here in Bensound. And they keep me on as detective sergeant. And finally, they so wanted to get rid of me out of the detective division, they put me in patrol as sergeant. But I didn't have one of the new uniforms that Chief Viola had ordered, who had now been fired. And this guy, Zajac, was brought back, who he had been fired. And they put me in a uniform patrol sergeant position in plain clothes. And for literally 3 weeks waiting my uniform to come in, I just wore like jeans and like an overcoat. And I'm driving around in a marked patrol car, and people didn't know what to make of it. So, but I finally got the uniform, did that for a few years. Then became an admin sergeant, kind of bossing the secretaries. I shouldn't, that's the wrong word, but supervising the secretaries and other crossing guards and stuff like that. And then I said, I got to get out of here. Chief Viola came back, politics changed, and I said, time to move on. And I started applying to the FBI. I did, got promoted. Before that, though, and Joe, you may be aware of this, I went to the FBI National Academy because I had no idea what my future would be. And that's a highly sought-after managerial school put on by the FBI for police administrators. So luckily, Viola and Robinson kind of signed me up for that. I went there for 11 weeks. While I'm there, my then-wife gets a letter in the mail, Jim, from the FBI, open it up. Oh, you have an interview from your test. So I was at the FBI National Academy. Graduated there, the 147th session. That was December of 86. November of 87, I'm back at the FBI Academy as a brand new special agent trainee. So there's a quick walkthrough of my Bensound career, lots of other stuff in there, Joe. As I know, you read my book, but that's kind of a summary of it.
I think it sums it up. And I was going to ask you about the NA. You were one of the few people I know that actually went to the National Academy that later became a special agent and had to go to basic agent training probably within, what would you say, about a year?
Yeah, it was like 11 months later.
Yeah, so it's, I've never seen anybody who went to the NA actually become a...
There's only about a dozen of us. I've done a little poll over the years. During World War II, the FBI under Hoover did recruit a lot of National Academy graduates.
Okay.
So that number's kind of inflated. But after that, because the FBI doesn't want to be seen as like stealing people
right,
from
right.
You know, local and state police departments. So they really didn't want it. So in a way, I found out years later, just talking to somebody, yeah, that could have hurt you, Fitz, the fact that you were an NA grad. Everything else was, you know, your background was on the money and all, but that could have hurt you. But fortunately, other people saw otherwise, and it was time to make. It was a big decision, by the way. I'm a local guy, grew up in Philly, now living just, you know, across the border in Bensound. I knew I'd be being sent somewhere else in the country, not Philly, and it was a very tough decision. And back then, you could choose New York City as one of your assignments out of the academy because it was a tough office to staff for high cost of living and everything else. And I said, you know what? I think I can do the two-hour commute up, two-hour commute back, because I found out there are about 40 other agents all living in Bucks County doing the same thing every day. So I jumped right in the carpool and did that for 7 years in New York City.
Let's, if you don't mind holding on, Jim, let's take a break here to listen to some of our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll pick up right where we left off.
Okay.
Thank you.
And the good news
crisis.
Is that
here at
What's
Bucks
more
County Elder Law,
family.
We're still
Hi,
servicing
I'm Henry
your
Carpenter.
Needs, making sure all of your planning is in order. We are operating as a completely virtual firm, holding all of our meetings by telephone or computer conference. In emergencies, we're doing drive-through document signings, meaning you never leave the safety and comfort of your car. Now is not the time to sit on the sidelines. Whatever your issues and concerns, please call us now at 215-493-0727. We offer a free consultation to answer your questions and to make sure your family is protected. Because at Bucks County Elder Law, it's all about family.
Follow WBCBNews.com for all your up-to-date local stories that affect your community. That's WBCBNews.com.
In 2022, Oxfam will fight inequality to create a future of equal rights and equal treatment so that everyone can thrive, not just survive. At OxfamAmerica.org, learn how you can offer life-saving support to people experiencing crises right now while working to tackle the root causes of poverty and injustice for the long term. Together, let's make equality a reality at OxfamAmerica.org. Sponsored by Oxfam America.
Tune in to WBCB every Thursday at 9:30 a.m. to Under the Hood, hosted by Fred Fletcher of Fletcher's Garage in Fairless Hills. Everything you need to know about keeping your car running smoothly. Fletcher's Garage is a AAA auto service and repair facility, PA state inspection and emissions, complete auto service. Tune in every Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. on WBCB 1490 for Under the Hood with Fred Fletcher at Fletcher's Garage, Hood, and South Olds Boulevard, Fairless Hills.
All commentators heard on WBCB express their own views. Their opinions are not necessarily those of others on WBCB, including the staff and management.
We now return to Bucks Blue. Once again, here are your hosts, Joe LeCompte and Yardley Borough Police Chief Joseph Kelly.
And welcome back to Bucks Blue, everyone. And our special guest this month is Jim Fitzgerald, retired FBI agent. Welcome back, Jim. And I wanted to comment a little bit about, you mentioned something before about your education. I know when I went through Seton Hall in 1989, your arch rival of your graduate school, criminal justice was like a side major to sociology. And it sounds like when you went through about a decade earlier, it wasn't even that. I wanted to acknowledge, because of the efforts of so many in this business and you know, you being a huge part of the forensic business, that forensics is now a topic that's even being addressed down at the high school level. In fact, my daughter's class at Phillipsburg High School and her teacher, Ange Merrick, are listening in right now and have been excited for the last 3 weeks to hear you. So I wanted to share that with you.
I'm very much aware of that, Joe, and I've probably presented about a half a dozen times, either in person or by Zoom, to high school classes. I've had a middle school kid, you know, email me asking for some stuff, and I got their parent involved and all. And so it's really an interesting trend where that is going. And I remember in my early days of the FBI, when I became early days of being a profiler. A lot of phone calls would come in through other agents and friends of agents. Hey, can you talk to my college age, you know, neighbor's kid? She, almost always a young woman, wants to be a profiler. And, you know, probably twice, three times a month, I'd be talking to someone. I wound up making this form up, like about, you know, 10 bullet points. I would either fax it off back then or email it to them. And then all of a sudden the calls died down. And then, more time to do my work. And then I talked to my buddies in the laboratory division of the FBI, and here they're now getting the calls. What was the difference? The show CSI kicked in, and everyone then, all these young people, wanted to be, you know, forensic specialists and investigators. But then Criminal Minds came back, or I should say, you know, became very popular, and I was actually one of their early technical advisors as soon as I retired. And then that came back into vogue. Then I started getting these phone calls again. And now that I'm a forensic linguist also, the TV show Manhunt Unabomber, maybe getting ahead of things here, Joe, but then that became popular and all kinds of requests about that. But to go back to your initial question, I think a lot of educational trends sort of start in the West and move eastward. And okay. I know there were some universities, UCLA, whatever, had some early criminal justice programs. And kind of interesting, when I was at Penn State in the early to mid 70s for the law enforcement and correction, there was a direct pipeline of NYPD officers, usually upper management, teaching there. And what a great gig for them. I'm sure they retired for 20 years living in the Bronx or, you know, in Queens somewhere, and they come to this idyllic area of State College, Pennsylvania. So, but they were some of my favorite instructors there. And, you know, they talk the talk, but at least in the past, they also walk the walk. uniform officers, detectives, things like that. So while I enjoyed the other professors, too, from their sort of theoretical backgrounds, I always found the ones with the practical background to be the most interesting and, I believe, the most edifying. And I'm teaching graduate courses now at the California University of Pennsylvania. It's a state school in PA out by Pittsburgh, soon to be Pennsylvania Western University.
Okay.
They've combined with a few other schools. But I'm teaching a grad course there now. And I certainly go into theory about linguistics and the science of it and sociolinguistics. But, you know, every few weeks I put a real case in there that they my students have to actually, figure out whatever I'm looking for, linguistic profile or authorial attribution analysis, comparing authorship, like I did in the Unabomb case. And they seem to enjoy that, too. So I think the best way of learning, and now from my perspective, the best way of teaching is to have, present the theory, present the theoretical side of things, but from a pedagogical perspective, also put those case examples in there, too, in a field like for forensic linguistics, and my students seem to appreciate it.
So you arrive in New York City, right? You put in for New York, and obviously not that many people want it, so you wind up being assigned to 26 Federal Plaza, I assume.
Yep,
and correct. You were assigned to the bank robbery squad, which has to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, and once again, they put me out in Brooklyn in a car theft squad, and I said, "Look, I'm driving from Bucks County every day, and a lot of other agents are, because I was actually encouraged to stay in Bucks County because they used to give out real estate brochures in New York to the agents. Hey, you can afford to live in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Well, how far away is that to these people from other parts of the country? And, oh, it's only 2 hours. But anyway, so I said, I can't, it's one thing coming to 26 Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan. I really don't feel like driving out to Brooklyn. And they said, no, that's right. So they kind of put me aside. And a lot of new agents go to the applicant squad. That's basically, it's a good way to learn paperwork, how to interview and talk to people. And all you're doing is you're interviewing people who apply to the FBI or apply to be a judge or some other, DOJ, assistant U.S. attorney.
Okay.
You would go out and do these interviews. And that's where a lot of young agents wound up. And they would really want to get on the bank robbery squad. And here I'm in there in this office with one of the big bosses. He's, all right, yeah, you shouldn't be going out to Brooklyn. That wouldn't be fair. Let me make a few phone calls. And how about the bank robbery squad, Fitzgerald? Yeah, I've caught my share of bank robbers in the time, which is true, and I did in about a year and a half before in Bensalem. And they said, well, I'll send you down to that squad. And this is a task force of NYPD detectives, FBI agents, about 10 of each, and they were very busy back then. There were about 450 bank robberies per year in New York City then, more than one a day. And there have been days later on that I actually hit all five boroughs in one day. But anyway, I go up and talk to the boss, John Coleman, and I sit down, and we don't bring rookies on the squad. I said, look, the assistant special agent in charge sent me here. What's your background again? I said, I was a police officer, Bensalem, a sergeant. For what it's worth, I mentioned the guy's name back in 86, and I think he was wanted for a bunch of different crimes. You arrested him? Yeah, we were looking for him. Well, I was the one that found him and arrested him after he robbed a bank in my town of Bensalem. Huh. All right, kid. We'll give you some time here, and hopefully it works out. And it did. And I fit in right with the detectives and the other special agents. And before long, I was kicking in doors of bank robbers and cop shooters and other types of offenses that we would handle in that squad, kidnapping, extortions. So
which
quite
leads
busy
us to one
from
of,
the
I'm sorry,
earliest Jim. Days.
Which leads us to one of your very high-profile cases, and one that I remember well. I was a junior in college at the time that DEA Special Agent Everett Hatcher was murdered. And I remember all the publicity living in the northern New Jersey area that came out of New York City with that. Could you walk us through a little bit about your involvement with that investigation?
Yeah, I was only on in the FBI about a year and a half, the bank robbery squad, and part of what we did on that squad was also investigate assaults on federal officers, even in other agencies. And DEA was part of the Department of Justice, so it was all under our tutelage. I get a call at 2 o'clock in the morning at home, never a good thing, of course. Yeah, can you come into work? There's been a DEA agent that was killed. Oh, boy. Sure. Where do you want me to go? And this is before cell phones and all. Meet us at top a certain bridge in Staten Island. So I was driving with another guy from Ben Salem and an agent who lived there, and we called each other, got in the car, took off, and we were on this bridge by about 3:30 a.m., all kinds of lights and lights flashing. Everett Hatcher's body had just been removed. And, to summarize, and there's a whole chapter in my third book on this, but Everett Hatcher was working undercover against sort of a mob wannabe named Gus Faraci. They did a bunch of phone calls first and finally a meeting. And Gus didn't like the look of this guy and just shot down from his passenger seat in his van, put his arm out the window and shot Everett Hatcher a few times in the head. And he was basically dead on the spot. His backup team should have been there. They somehow lost the eye, as they say, and Hatcher was murdered in his car. The van took off. Next thing you know, they put a task force together of about 15 of us, DEA, FBI, NYPD, ATF, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and we hunted for this mob wannabe for the next 9 months or so, and just missing him sometimes by a day. And this was my first incursion, if you will, into the world of organized crime, the mafia, you know, the five families in New York. John Gotti was the head of the five families. And I wound up, you know, talking to a bunch of soldiers, as they call them, made guys, lieutenants, capos. Never talked to Gotti himself, but eventually some other agents did, and didn't go real well for him. But it was very interesting dealing with these people. And we basically, you know, we told them, we want Gus. We'll leave you alone when we get Gus, and we want him alive. And we got Gus's cousin to cooperate. We found out where the gun was. It was threw it in a body of water. The FBI dive team finally found it on their last day in one of the Staten Island kills or bodies of water. And it all just went from there. And and the race was on. Who's going to get him? And it turns out the mob was looking for him too. We started violating people's probations, paroles. I knocked on one guy's door because we knew he crossed a state line without, you know, his parole officer's permission out of Florida. And we knocked on his door around 12 noon. He answers it in his robe and with his hair all mussed. Oh, well, yeah, FBI, yeah, come on in. And we go into it. He said, you're under arrest, parole violation for crossing state lines on this date. And, can I turn off my tea kettle? And you know, we let him go in. And there on his kitchen table, he has the newspaper laid out, a pair of scissors, and a bunch of coupons that he cut out to go to the store later that day. So even he was a lieutenant in, I think, the Bonanno family. And here he is cutting coupons to go to the supermarket, still wearing his bathrobe at 12 noon. But, you know, get dressed. You're coming with us. And he never gave up anything he knew about Gus. Again, I've said this a few times today, Joe, but long story short, Gus was finally found at an intersection in Brooklyn on one, Saturday evening. The mob people caught up with him, and they basically executed him on the spot. Eventually, those guys were arrested, whatever. But that brought an end to the hunt for Gus Faraci. It's interesting, back in the late 80s and mid 90s, I worked the two cases with the largest FBI rewards ever. And it was $500,000 or something for the arrest of Gus Faraci. And then later, as the Unabomber, it was $1 million. And of course, that was superseded by 9/11 when it was $25 million for Osama bin Laden. But at least I certainly worked that case too. But my early FBI career definitely involved some high reward oriented cases, which the rewards never really, you know, paid off in actually identifying them. But nonetheless, it was interesting being involved in those cases back then. So yeah, I learned a lot about the mob guys and how they think, how they operate, how their wives think and operate. And we would show them some pictures, not even intentionally. You know, 10 pictures of surveillance of their husband. There's one who's with his guma, which is like the Italian thing for girlfriend. And, yeah, I know who she is. I don't care what my husband does on Friday nights. As long as he's home Saturday mornings, take me and the kids out shopping. Okay. What does your husband do for a living, by the way? I don't know. Well, he brings home a paycheck, right? It's usually cash. What does he do? I don't know. And you know what, Joe? They were probably telling the truth.
Yep.
They honestly didn't know.
I suspect they were.
So, but we knew, of course, and they were involved in illegal activity. So, yeah, very interesting time frame there working that case. Learned a lot.
Let's take another break here, and then when we get back, I want to talk. I want to spend the last 20 minutes or so talking about the biggest case you've probably worked, being the Unabomber. So if you could hold on, and we're going to hear from some of our great sponsors.
A fleet of 200 brewers in stock at all times, Pat Dion Beverages now features 5 different flavors of their favorite slushy cocktails. You can also purchase all your wine, liquor, and other fine spirits right next door. Visit us on Facebook or online at patdionbeverages.com for upcoming events and samples from your favorite brewery or local food vendor.
Fall into relaxation at Hand and Stone Massage and Facial Spa. For an introductory price of just $69.95, enjoy the tranquility of their massage services and the rejuvenating glow their facial services provide. They even have specialty services such as a pumpkin facial or their signature hot stone massage. Restore, relax, and reset at one of Hand and Stone's 57 locations in Delaware, South Jersey, and Philadelphia, including the Lehigh Valley. For an introductory price of just $69.95, call or book online at handandstone.com. Restrictions apply. See spa for details.
WBCB is now on your FM dial at 107.3. Serving Bucks, Burlington, and Mercer counties since 1958, you can now listen to all of your BCB favorites crystal clear on 107.3 FM. A new age for WBCB on a new frequency, 107.3.
We now return to Bucks Blue. Once again, here are your hosts, Joe LeCompte and Yardley Borough Police Chief Joseph Kelly.
And welcome back, everyone, to Bucks Blue. We're speaking to retired Supervisory Special Agent Jim Fitzgerald of the U.S. FBI, formerly in the Behavioral Analysis Unit. And when we went to break, Jim, we were starting to talk about your involvement in a case that probably fascinated and alarmed everyone in the United States for decades. And for those who haven't seen Manhunt Unabomber, I know not all the facts in there are technically correct, but your involvement in this case obviously was key to his apprehension and then later conviction. So if you could walk us through this case a little bit, I think our listeners would love to hear about it.
Sure, Joe. And before we get into it, I just want to give a shout-out to my sister, Cass. She just got out of the hospital after about a week, and she's home now, and her birthday's coming up in a few days. So really happy birthday, Cass. I know you're going to feel better in a few days, and we'll do that birthday luncheon together. So having said that, I was like everyone reading newspaper accounts. I remember as a young officer in Bensalem, you know, reading the Philadelphia Inquirer on, you know, some early morning shifts when everything's quiet. And there's I remember the early 80s or so, this strange acronym, Unabomb, that the FBI coined. And said, there's some crazy bomber out there. Huh? That's interesting. I wonder why. And I just, you know, all right, let me go, oh, there's a guy running a red light. Let me go write a ticket. So, you know, I kind of forget about it. And then here I joined the FBI in New York 7 years, promoted to supervisor, go back to Quantico to get 12 weeks of profiling training, and John Douglas, Mindhunter himself from his books and the TV show, he's one of the training agencies just about ready to retire in June of 95, and he does like a two-hour block on the Unabomb case because he had developed the early profiles in it. There had been some early letters from the Unabomber, and I was just listening intently to it, never realizing within weeks essentially the torch would be passed to me, and I would be the next profiler assigned to that case. But unlike him, I did it full time. They had me go out to San Francisco and join the Unabomb task force. I showed up in early July of 95, right after the manifesto was received by the New York Times and some other entities. So I'm an experienced investigator from Bensalem, from New York. I'm a brand new trained profiler. I have no forensic linguistic training at this point. I was not a linguist at this point, a master's in psychology from Villanova. And I come out there, and I'm the first one that pointed out from a 1985 letter, there was this strange sort of thing called an acrostic. I looked up that word back then, but I figured what it was. I figured what it was first, and I determined what the word meant. And that's a hidden message written like vertically in a in someone's poem or a book chapter or whatever. And Edgar Allan Poe used to do it. I think E.E. Cummings and a few other, Lewis Carroll. And so in the 1985 letter that the Unabomber attached to a bomb to trick a University of Michigan professor to open it up, there was an acrostic that I found reading the left-hand column down, "Dad, it is I." And I wasn't sure what it meant, but when I showed up at the UTF with the big boss and the other people in charge of running it, I said, "Yeah, what about this thing for the 85 letter? And what are you talking about? Dad, it is I. What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, look," and I had a copy of it, not the original, of course. And holy mackerel, when did you see that? I'm not using the profanity that was actually used, Joe, since I know where
I appreciate that, Joe.
But holy heck, Fitz, what is that? And they call up DOJ, get the top guy in Washington. Did anyone ever see this before? And, you know, well, this guy just showed up, Fitzgerald, from the profiling unit. And, "Dad, it is, what does it mean, Fitz? You're the profiler." He could have daddy issues. He could have parental issues. I don't know for sure. But so that's in my book. It's in the miniseries, Man on Unabomber. So anyway, they said, "All right, Fitz, I like this. So I know you're a profiler, but you're basically going to be in charge of all these new documents, the manifesto." So, you know, my profiling skills were only, you know, classroom oriented at that point. I've always been avid reader and puzzle taker, crosswords, Scrabble games, things like that. So I always enjoyed language and how different parts of the country speak differently. And if anyone's watched the miniseries, there are some falsehoods that I did my best to argue with the writer and director about. Some I won, some I lost. But one thing that is accurate is I was confronted by someone out there, you know, after a week or two in San Francisco when I said, "Oh, yeah, where's the water fountain?" Now, most of your listeners, well, what did he say wrong? But us in Philly, southeastern Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey, we say water. Most of the rest of the country says water. And it's a slight, you know, phonological difference there. And it's, you know, whole history goes back behind it linguistically. But people picked up on that. "Oh, what are you from, New York?" I said, "No, I'm from Philly, but that's an interesting point." And that was exemplified in the miniseries, I think, in the first episode, when Sam Worthington says water and his colleagues kind of make fun of me. It sort of happened the same way with me. It was a light type of humor. I said, "You know what? You're right, though. Language does mean something, whether it's spoken or written. And maybe we can use this guy's language. We have this manifesto now. What other criminal writes a manifesto? This is so much evidence we never had before. And I know there's nothing on the bombs. There's nothing on his earlier letters, meaning no fingerprints, no DNA in the early days of DNA analysis, you know, for forensic purposes, no hairs and fibers, nothing. And indented writing, nothing, or all these red herrings that came up." I said, "I'm going to focus on this guy's writing. The bosses were supportive because of that dad at his eye thing." And that's really what I that was my priority for the whole time there. And actually, unlike in the miniseries, I did get along with my bosses. They respected me. I respected them. Hollywood likes to make, you know, divisiveness and, you know, people arguing with each other. But on the whole, I got along with them very well. And the other big, yeah, mistruth, if you will, or really literary license in this series, no FBI agent ever sat down with Ted Kaczynski. And that includes me.
Okay.
I argued. Don't put those scenes in. It makes no sense. I even said, "How about making a dream sequence for the Fitz character, you know, portrayed by Sam?" "Oh, we can't do that." And they finally said, "Look," I didn't talk to them for a week. I wouldn't return their calls. The writers, the directors, I met with them in person. I had flown to L.A. a few times. But now when I finally got these scripts, I said, I don't want to talk to you. So I finally had no choice but to sort of acquiesce. They also wanted to put me at the scene of the arrest. And, you know, and I wasn't there either. I was back in San Francisco putting everything together the last minute to get the search warrant done. And that's where, you know, you can't eat your cake and have it in, and can't eat your cake and have it too comes into play here. And that was kind of something in the last week or so that I had found and whatever. And I said, no, there's one cardinal rule that, you know, law enforcement agents and officers know. You don't try to steal someone else's arrest. If you didn't throw the handcuffs on someone, you don't claim that. And as an aside here, Joe, there's an officer right now in Bensalem whose father worked on Bensalem who claims that the father made the arrest of a priest back in 1983 or 1982 when I did it. And it's just, it's so bogus. It's just that rule. It's unwritten. You never claim you made another arrest. So if you read the reviews for my second book, you'll see this guy's what he wrote, and I have a retort to it. But going back to the Unabom case, it just doesn't. I said no, don't do that, and they did. I said I won't have anything to do with this. I won't publicize or anything. The series when it comes out, they said, all right, you're not there for the arrest. So that's the miniseries.
Let me ask you this about the miniseries, if I can, Jim. Was the part about you seeing the brother accurate and selling your profile to him?
No, I never met any Kaczynski.
Okay.
There were other agents. They kind of, and I understand this part in a movie or a miniseries, mm-hmm. there have to be composite characters. There has to be compressed time. It would be a documentary otherwise, which if made right, they can be interesting. But for a scripted series, it just doesn't work that way. So I didn't have as much problem with some of those scenes as just sitting with Kaczynski. That just didn't happen. He barely talked to his own attorneys. He refused to do a psych eval. He just, until finally they convinced him, you know, it's us or you're going to get, you know, the death penalty. And he finally listened to them and talked to them. So there are a few scenes in there, including I never left the real Fitz, that's me, never left his kids in a movie theater because he got paged about something big breaking in the Unabom case. But the other parts of it, they did a good job. And, you know, the dates and the times, the names, and, you know, the essence of how serious the FBI took it and how frustrating it was. But I was never sent home from the UTF. I just did. My bosses in Quantico wanted me back, quite frankly. And they, all right, Fitz, you've been out there 5.5 months. The manifesto's published. You got a bunch of leads coming in. Nothing happened. So to finish up that part of the story, Joe, just I'm back in Quantico. They send me a bunch of faxes. For younger people, a fax machine is a piece of paper, you know, go from one place to another. Now it'll be scanned. But I was looking at a bunch of notes that people wrote. And, hey, Fitz, could this be the Unabomber? No. Could this be him? Letter? No. How about this one? Give me an hour or two here, 23 pages long. I looked at it and said, this is even an elaborate plagiarism, or you've got your man. And I've been quoted using that term.
Okay.
I said, Fitz, it's not a plagiarism. You're coming back to San Francisco. So I flew back, and they wouldn't even tell me over the phone who their suspect was. Finally, the person who picked me up at the airport said, are you sitting down? Your early profile, or your profile was pretty much on the money. He lives by himself in a cabin. He's a former professor, and his brother, you know, recognized the writings and turned them in. I was a strong proponent of publishing the manifesto. There's at least one agent on the task force in sort of management position said, no, we don't want to do it. But we finally, convinced him otherwise. And we did publish it, and we got a bunch of phone calls coming in, you know, emails, whatever, back in the day. But finally, we got the right one from a lawyer representing David Kaczynski. And in fact, but that still didn't make the case. People to this day, seasoned investigators, well, the brother turned him in, right? Yeah, okay. So you get a brother calling you that his brother robbed a bunch of banks. You out and arrest him based on that? You have to build your case first. Of course you have to build your case first. And that's what we did over the next 6-7 weeks. CBS had a leak. A leak came out of DOJ, Department of Justice. Dan Rather called the director. We know you've got someone in Lincoln, Montana. We had to move the arrest up by weeks, and we had 3 days at the end there to put everything together. And that's why I stayed back in San Francisco. The SWAT team and everybody else was out in Lincoln, Montana, and the arrest went down without anyone being hurt. and the Unabomber's career was done then. It took about 2 years for the prosecution. Never went to trial, but he did plead guilty, and Ted is in, well, he was in Florence, Colorado, the Supermax, but I understand a month or two ago he was taken to another facility for some medical reasons. But he's definitely still out there alive and kicking.
But that had to be so rewarding when you're writing that affidavit of probable cause for your search warrant to, you know, this has never been done before, right? I mean, forensic linguistics were never used on a search warrant affidavit before and an arrest warrant affidavit. And to get that
never
past the judge and to know that you were an integral part of that must have been very rewarding to you.
Yeah, it was a 50-page document that was part of the search warrant. It's still online if you look for, I think it's under Turchi affidavit, you know, Unabom Turchi, T-U-R-C-H-I-E affidavit. And there's 50 pages of mine right in the middle of it there and some paragraphs of his. And it's also online. I think I put it on my website, jamesrfitzgerald.com. And all these papers are about to be published, all my Unabom documents at California University of Pennsylvania, I'm told, any week now.
Okay.
So I'll have a media blitz when that happens. But a very interesting case. It changed forensics in the U.S. It certainly got me involved in linguistics. I went back to school, got a second master's degree at Georgetown University, and I'm very glad I did that. Now, even in retirement from the FBI, I'm still an active criminal profiler and forensic linguist when someone calls and needs some help.
And you actually moved out of our area, right? You now live in New Jersey, I believe?
Yeah, I'm down in the Cape May area of New Jersey, but still busy as a consultant. My company,
okay,
JamesRFitzgerald.com, and travel around the world still if people request it, and to help out on cases or do some training.
And although you weren't there the day of the arrest, I think this is interesting, too. You were able to travel out to Lincoln, Montana, right, and see the cabin?
Oh, yeah. 3 days afterwards, they wanted me there because they found that 1,000 new documents in the cabin. So they flew me and my team out, and I did walk in the cabin, much like the scene where Sam walked in there I think that was episode 7.
Okay.
The only thing I was upset about, he touched the typewriter key, and he picked something up. I said, no, you don't touch anything at a crime scene. But besides that, they still got it done pretty well there in the miniseries.
And I imagine by the time you got out there 3 days after the arrest, that place must have been mobbed, not only with media, but with law enforcement from everywhere.
Yeah, and helicopters flying over and media people trying to get talk to everyone. But I'll tell you what, if you go on my website, there are some side-by-side pictures of, and it's jamesrfitzgerald.com, of the cabin, the real cabin, and the cabin that was made by Manhunt Unabomber. Really cool.
So you've never spoken to or corresponded with Kaczynski. He's never reached out for you from jail.
I've sent him. I sent him one letter
in
2016. He never responded, and I did try to talk to him in 2007. But as I was driving, I was already out in Colorado doing some training at the Air Force Academy, and I had it set up months in advance. Remember, he's in the Supermax, 23 hours a day in his jail cell by himself. I have it all set up. I'm driving down the interstate to go interview him, and the correctional officer calls me and says, Agent Fitzgerald, yeah, Mr. Kaczynski said he can't talk to you today because he's busy. So that was his little way. Ted probably thought I flew all the way out there just to see him because he'd already agreed to talk to me, but then at the last minute he canceled it. It so happens I was already in Colorado, so it wasn't a wasted trip. And as soon as I heard that phone call, I took that phone call from the officer at the prison. I saw a sign ahead of me saying Pikes Peak. I made a quick right into the exit, and I climbed Pikes Peak. So I think I had a better day than Kaczynski in any event.
Oh, I would imagine you did, yeah. We have 2 minutes left, Jim. Could you tell us what's next? I think volume 4 of Journey to the Center of the Mind is coming out, right?
It is. I am writing it now. I wrote 3 books in less than 5 years. And I took a little bit of a break, a lot of work with the miniseries, whatever. I've got a couple projects. Yeah, so that book is being written. And also, whether you watch the miniseries or not, check out The Fitz Files, Manhunt Unabomber. It's an audiobook I did, I released about a year ago. And I interviewed the director, the writer, my friend Jim Clemente, also retired FBI, and other people in it about the making of the miniseries. and it's 8 chapters, and I break down every episode in the beginning of the chapter, talk to people afterwards. So that's out there, too, for people. My website has a lot of travel stuff I'm doing, but I'm working on some podcasts. I'm working on some TV ideas, and nothing that's, you know, etched in stone yet. But, yeah, just keep your eyes and ears open, and I'll have it out there on Twitter and Facebook, and just follow me, and you'll know everything about me. But also check out my my website, jamesrfitzgerald.com, and everything will be made known there.
Well, I want to thank you, Jim, not only for coming on, but for your decades of service, not only as a municipal police officer, but as an FBI agent. The cases you contributed to obviously made a difference to society and saved lives. So I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you for taking an hour out of your day today to share the experiences with the people and the followers of Bucks Blue and our Bucks County residents. And hopefully someday when there's another, you know, another book out, we can get you back on to talk about that.
Well, I'd be glad to, Joe. Thank you for this opportunity. I know you went through something back in the summertime, and thank God you're still here to talk to us about it. And that just shows you what law enforcement goes through every day in big cities and even in small towns. So thank you for your service, and I'd be glad to come back on your show anytime.
I appreciate it, Jim. And with that, we're going to go to a sponsor and come back.